I have this reputation, which is probably deserved, of being the person that gets bored with things. H especially takes the piss out of me. He's like, oh, it's been going on for 30 seconds. Mark's going to be bored with it. The idea of doing something new, you know, something a little bit risky, I like that, you know. And it's kind of worked for me, you know.
What's the biggest risk you've ever taken?
It's like joining Marillion, you know, just quitting my course and this, you know, yeah. Going off and joining a band.
Welcome to Prog and Progeny.
It's very quiet around here, isn't it? Just you and me. No guest.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. We have had a lot of guests on recently. That was good with Eric last week.
Yeah. I actually have to do one of those corrections. You know, when we were talking about the musical mystery competition, which comes up in this chapter, I said it was the prize was £25,000. I misremembered it. The prize was £4,000. But we spent £25,000 with the company 1,000 Heads doing the promotion. They charged us that to do it.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
I was going to say £25,000 is so much money, even now.
Yeah, it kind of stuck in my head. But I think it was that was what it cost them to, well, it's what they charged us to organise it all, create the website, do all the promotion. Before we start, I just wanted to say, we don't normally do this, and I know it can be a bit annoying for people, but for everybody watching on YouTube and all the other, you know, the podcasts that we distribute through Apple and Spotify and all that, you may not be aware that we have a Patreon page, which is how we support the podcast. So it's Prog and Progeny, if you search it on Patreon. And if you sign up, it's a small monthly fee, or you can pay yearly and get 20% discount. We have bonus episodes from time to time, music that I've made that you wouldn't hear anywhere else. Live episodes, yeah.
We've only done one of, but we will do again because we enjoyed it.
Yeah, that was good. You get to influence what we might talk about in the future. We have questions, episodes that we answer. We also do gig meetups, so we've got a lot of gigs coming up. So if you want to meet up at one of the gigs, sign up. And
you'll get birthday messages.
Birthday messages, yeah. Birthday video messages for anybody who wants ones. If you're a Patreon subscriber and you haven't given us your birthday, don't forget. We can send you a nice little message on your birthday. And you'll get a warm glow knowing that your money is helping Tallulah out while she's looking for a job.
Well, you make it sound like charity, yes.
No, it's not charity. You're working. You're doing all the editing.
It's very helpful. And yeah.
Someone's got to do the work, right? It's not... Nobody wants to work for free. Please sign up at Patreon. Thank you. Okay, that's all the advertising, the plugging out of the way. Let's get into the chapter, shall we?
So chapter starts with a very nice description of Port Zealand.
Yeah, because Phil, my ghostwriter who helped me with the book, actually came and reviewed one of our weekends. So he wrote that description, and I think that opening passage in the chapter kind of describes how he experienced it. So how he describes it with all the, you know, all the flags that people have hanging outside of their chalets and everybody cycling around and Marillion's music playing everywhere. It is quite a surreal experience as a member of the band to be in that environment, but it's a lot of fun. Mm. Well, you've been there, haven't you?
It's surreal experiences. As someone who's associated with the band, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah. How does it feel?
Like it's the only time I've ever felt like you're famous.
Right. Because everywhere we go, everybody says hello. And
yeah.
You know.
It's kind of the same as if you play a small town, like when we went to Loo in Cornwall as well for that festival, you just see a lot of people. Everyone says hi to you. Yeah, and hi Mark. Like, have you seen Pluribus?
Pluribus, yeah.
It's like that. Yeah. Hi Carol. say some people are like a bit starstruck, but people are just mainly friendly, and I think that's what's quite nice is like you guys have a very good relationship with, you know, fans, and it just feels like everyone's like, hey Mark, how are you? You know, it doesn't feel like
intrusive.
No,
not at all. But it kind of gives you a little window into what it must be like to be really famous in the wider world, you know.
Except, kind of, but I don't. Yeah, kind of.
But yeah, but then I think somebody who is really famous that literally everybody recognises would probably find it a little bit daunting after a while, because it's not something you want to live with all your life, you know. And not everybody, I suppose, in that situation is going to be a huge fan. Even if they recognise you, they might be hostile towards you or tell you that your last movie was shit or something, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And people might like secretly film you or whatever, whereas like...
I'm too
nervous to say hi, whereas with you, it's not. It doesn't. Yeah,
everybody's
feel
really
like
pleasant.
That as much.
No, yeah. Not at all. Everybody's very pleasant, and actually, I have to say, even at gigs, people are generally give you your space. They kind of don't intrude, or you know, most people don't just walk up to your table if you're eating and start talking to you. That sort of
thing. Yeah, it's quite civilized. So, like it's
exactly.
Not,
yeah. Well, we have. Civilized fans, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure you've had some bad moments, but... Yeah.
Well, not really. I mean, there was only one interaction that I can recall, and I don't remember it at the time, but somebody posted a comment on... I think I might have talked about this, that I basically refused to sign something for them and just pushed them out of the way, walked past them at a festival once. But I don't remember doing it, and didn't sound like me. So maybe I was just having a bad day. But he was pretty pissed off with me, and made it known on
recently.
Facebook. A few years ago, I think. But the incident happened many years ago. He was basically saying that I was a twat. you know, a few people stuck up for me. But
yeah, I feel like if you're having a bad day.
Well, that's what I said. I said maybe I was thinking, well, if it's in an audience in a festival, maybe I didn't want to stop because then lots of people would come round and start, you know, asking and then you'd be stuck, you know. But he said, yeah, no, there was nobody around, you know. Okay, I've got an excuse then. I was just having a bad day.
There's a big theme of risk taking.
Yeah, so the whole idea of the crowdfunding thing.
An idea that's not dangerous is unworthy of being called an idea at all. You quote Oscar Wilde.
Oscar Wilde, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have this reputation, which is probably deserved, of being the person that gets bored with things, you know, whether it's if we're writing a song and it carries on in the same set of chords for too long, I'm bored. And people, you know, H especially takes the piss out of me. He's like, oh, it's been going on for 30 seconds. Mark's going to be bored with it. He's going to want to change it now. Or when we're jamming.
It happened
yesterday. we were playing this musical idea, which I'd kind of started. And then just as H was starting, because he looks at his lyrics and he's deciding what he's going to sing, you know, and he's hearing the music and we're playing around. And then he's just about to start singing. And then I changed it. And he's like, oh, why? Why every time I start singing, you change it? You're getting bored already, you know. So it's not intentional. I start doing something, and then after a little while, I'm thinking it needs to change. It needs to change. You know? Or I'm just looking for something else to go with it, you know. Mm. But that's that's part of the process, really. But yeah, the idea of doing something new, you know, something a little bit risky, I like that, you know. And as yeah. as I wrote in the book, something along the lines of, you know, you try something risky and if it doesn't work out, you're going to try something else. And it's kind of worked for me, you know.
What's the biggest risk you've ever taken?
Well, things like joining Marillion, you know, I was a student.
You've actually been very risky.
You know, just quitting my course and this, you know, going off and joining a band. You know, because as I said, I don't know if people remember, but Jack Grigger, the bass player from Chemical Alice, we invited him to come and audition after we fired Diz and before we found Pete. And he was like, no, well, I've got my I've got my job, I've got my motorbike that I need to pay for, and I've got a girlfriend, and like, come on, you know. It's like, this is a, all right, I saw it as an opportunity. Some people would see it as a huge risk, you know. So it's that sort of thing, really. But I was like, the excitement of doing something new and different. And that was what appealed to me about the crowdfunding thing. It was like, wow, nobody's done this before. This could be really cool, you know. Let's do it.
I've had friends who did business studies at uni, and there's always a lecture on crowdfunding, and I often get a text saying, your dad came off of my lecture today. You're still credited with starting it.
Yeah, well, we did. Yeah, it was our idea, really. I mean, you know, I suppose Jeff Pelletier, who sent me an email, a nice email saying, "Oh, thanks for mentioning me. I still get a little thrill when I think I was involved in the whole
Well, it was
tour
his
fund." It was actually,
brainchild in a way,
yeah, the tour fund idea, which wasn't really crowdfunding, was his idea, and I think it was just a. Well, like the crowdfunding, like the, oh, let's ask the fans to pay for the album in advance idea. It's not really a, not like a
It's not
genius
that
moment. No, it's not that
shocking, yeah.
clever. Yeah, and that's what I always say. It's just it was, which is why I call the chapter Mother of Invention, as in, you know, a necessity is the mother of invention. You know, we had a need, and it was like that was the solution, and it was kind of obvious once we did it, you know, which is why lots of people copied it.
But
So,
credit where credit's due. It was your idea.
well, and we did it first.
Also, within the band, it sounds like it was you and Eric and maybe Lucy driving it.
Yeah, Lucy was always, see, I think Lucy's always up for new ideas. She, you know, we sometimes get together and have a little brainstorming session about, oh, what can we do next? You know,
Well,
let's
she
think of
did the
some.
whole Marillion Weekends thing, didn't she?
Exactly. Again, that was, and I was more skeptical about that, about the success of it than she was.
Yeah, you
You know,
sound a bit
about,
snobby when you're talking about that.
oh, about Butlins and
Yeah,
Pontins.
that was. I don't want to play at
Well, as I said,
Butlins.
I'd never been to Butlins. I'm not snobby. I've never been to Butlins because we couldn't afford it when I was a kid. Well, yeah, Pontins is a, it's not Centre Parks, put it like that, you know. And no disrespect to anybody who has a childhood holiday memory of going to Butlins, you know. Yeah, the Centre Parks in the Netherlands, to be fair, is not as good as the ones in the UK. In you know in
The ones in the
the.
UK are expensive.
They're very expensive. You don't go there if you're looking for a cheap holiday. It's
No.
more about if you don't want to go abroad, you know,
Yeah.
if you've lost your passport or something, you know. I think as well, it's like, I don't know, they charge like
If you've got young kids, it's like, yeah, a more stress-free
less.
way to have a.
Yeah, you don't have to get on a plane and you don't need sunshine because they have those big domes, you know, with all the what's the tropical swimming pool
Yeah, the
area.
swimming for the oasis or whatever.
We went there a few times, didn't we, Taluna, when you were little? It was
Yeah.
fun. We had a great
Yeah,
time.
it's classic divorced dad holiday.
Yeah. We had Storm come once. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Storm listens to these episodes when she's our podcast when she's cooking, apparently.
Does she?
She finds it very funny, is what Lila said.
It's funny when I speak to people. People are so complimentary about the podcast. It's really nice.
Really?
Yeah, I went to see Elbow last night at the Royal Albert Hall. They did a Teenage Cancer Trust gig, and I met up with Phil Chadwick, who is their manager. He listens to the podcast, and he said he's almost caught up. So,
Can
hi,
I get
Phil.
tickets to Elbow, please?
Ask here, and Phil will hear. So, yeah, I don't think they're doing any more gigs this year, but
I
next time.
really want to see them.
They were really good. It was a really nice gig. The audience participation was amazing. Well, the audience singing a high note, and then they did harmonies,
Oh,
and
wow.
the audience were really musical. It was really good. Honestly, I've never heard such a tuneful audience.
Wow.
Come on, Marillion audience. Anyway, we're still jumping around, so let's jump back to the chapter.
Yeah, so speaking of Lucy and the Centre Parks weekends, you hired her to be your marketing communications manager. But then, after she booked all those weekends, you she decided she preferred the managerial role and kind of took that on more.
Yeah, when we asked her to come and work for us, our idea was that she would do the promotional marketing stuff that Eric wasn't interested in doing and wasn't really his thing because he was more on the back office technical side of things. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what she was doing at EMI, so it kind of made sense, you know?
Are we going to address the elephant in the room about her correcting what Eric said in our last episode?
Oh, we can do, yeah. what did she say?
Eric said that the reason she didn't become like the face talking about crowdfunding is because she didn't like to be in the spotlight. But she said in a comment on our Patreon that actually it was because, which I can completely believe, she went to some meetings and they were all sexist and wouldn't listen to her.
So back then, not long after that, this was probably around about 2009, 2010, when I was involved in the Featured Artist Coalition. There was a kind of a companion group for the managers called the Music Managers Forum. And I encouraged Lucy to go along to their meetings, and Eric was involved with them. And I remember what she said. She basically went along. She was trying to get some of the managers interested in pushing back against venues that charge so much money for merchandise. You know, they basically take 25-30% of your merchandise take as a kind of fee for allowing you to sell your merchandise in their venues, which is horrible. Yeah. And she was pushing back against that, trying to get all the managers to, you know, get on side and basically boycott the venues that were doing it. But you needed obviously a lot of managers to take part. And they were just completely useless. And not only that, but she felt like they just ignored her because she was a woman. You know, she said there's a bunch of old white guys who, you know, were just up their own asses. In fact, was I think how she described it. So she stopped going because she was fed up with it.
Right.
And she felt like she wasn't being listened to, which I think is fair enough. So, but I don't think that had much to do with what happened with Marillion and the way her role changed. We're going to have to get Lucy on, aren't we? Hear it from her herself. But yeah, it was certainly the case that she knew Cyril Wilcox through EMI because Stranglers were on EMI. And Cyril, their manager, was the guy that kind of organised the very first, like a weekend for Stranglers fans, basically, at Pontins. That was how he gave Lucy the idea. In fact, it was Andy Rotherham who worked for us. He was a big Stranglers fan, big Marillion fan. And he went along to their weekend and told Lucy about it. I think that's what happened. So Andy does guitars for us occasionally and has been involved, you know, with the band for years. And so that was the connection to us hearing about the weekend that the Stranglers did. And then Lucy contacted Cyril and asked him to help organise the first Marillion weekend, which he did. So
yeah, because that model, I'm surprised you're sceptical because it's perfect for you.
Yeah. What I was sceptical about was the number of tickets that we would sell. I thought we would struggle to sell it. Because at that time...
Why were you worried about that?
Because at that time we weren't particularly... Our ticket sales hadn't really recovered from the dip in the 90s. This was like, we're talking 2002 was the first weekend that we did. And it was an untried thing for us. Mm. And it was in Pontins and, you know, it just seemed... Like no, but just because it's
Pontins.
Just because it's a bit out of the way on the west coast. It's
where even is in Bristol?
It's kind of sort of Western Super Mareway, Breen Sands. So it just seemed a bit of a stretch for fans to come to go that far. It's not like it was in the centre of Birmingham or London or Manchester. You know, it's a bit out of the way. Yeah. But I was wrong because it sold out. I think it was 1,500 people, something like that?
1,600.
Yeah, okay. You've got the numbers in front of you.
1,650, you wrote. I haven't, they're all in here.
Okay. I bet Lucy that it wouldn't sell more than 1,000 or something like that. And if it did, I would eat a bowl of tripe. For people that don't know
That's fish, right?
tripe. No, tripe is made from the parts of the animal that nobody wants to eat.
So no.
It's a sheep. It's like a bit like haggis. It's the stomach, whatever, all mashed up with some herbs and spices to make it taste like something decent, and then put in the stomach like a sausage, you know. I think that's what it is. I've never had it.
Maybe for our subscribers, we could video you doing that.
What, eating tripe? Yeah. No way. I don't even eat liver, never mind tripe.
Well, before we move off crowdfunding, because I know that we did talk about, like, kind of exhausted it with Eric, I want to talk a little bit about, you thought that by asking people to prepay, fans would want some sort of creative control over the album. Was that ever a proper concern?
It was. I remember we had discussions about it and how we would deal with it if people started, you know, writing to us and saying, well, you know, we want to have some sort of input into what you do since we're paying for it in advance. It was a genuine concern.
Did people do that?
No, I don't think, not as far as I'm aware. And I think if people
ever
thought...
It'd be a bit weird to do that.
I think it would, yeah, because, you know, we're trying to be creative and do something different.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Yeah, I think you should just let people who do the job do it themselves without outside interference. We always take that approach with creative people that we work with, you know.
Yeah. Did any of your concerns actually materialize then or not? Was it all just quite smooth sailing?
No, I think it was all smooth. Well, apart from the credit card company.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Getting suspicious about us taking all these payments for something that didn't exist, which kind of does sound a bit like a scam. yeah. No, you know. But no, it was great. It was really, I suppose there's quite a few ways it could have all gone wrong, but it didn't. And everybody says, oh, you should have patented it, you would have made a load of money. Or the other thing that people always used to say was that the band should have gone into, you know, could have become a Kickstarter. We could have started our own business.
Yeah.
And we did talk about it. We talked about it because once it was a success in 2001, it was like, okay, we could repeat this for other bands. And we kind of toyed with the idea of becoming a record label and getting other artists. And Wes, John Wesley, who I saw on the cruise, and he's going to come on the podcast, was our kind of our first client, first artist that we kind of signed up. So I made an album with Wes. And we were selling it through Racket. So, but we kind of realized, okay, if we grew this business and then signed up other bands and became the
music.
Became the record company, exactly, became the business that you know, got into the business of selling CDs and shipping them and all that stuff. I mean, we do it all for ourselves, but we realized that then it would take us away from what we actually want to be doing.
You could have employed people to do it for you, though. You would have made enough money to do that.
Yeah, but then you have to invest, right? And you have to risk some of your own money to grow that business.
I do think it could have been a very lucrative thing, but you didn't want to do it because it would take away from your career, and that's fair enough. But I've heard stories where you have had a few near misses of making a lot of money in your life.
That's true, yeah.
You really have, like when you bought all that Bitcoin.
Oh, come on. Everybody bought Bitcoin and sold it before it was worth hundreds of thousands of pounds.
Yeah.
Well, anyway.
Can you think of any more?
What, near misses?
There was
almost
another one.
What's there?
I feel like there was.
I'm happy. I don't need to make lots of money.
I know you are.
So, you know, this is the thing. I feel like having had a career making music for more than 40 years, that's a success that most people would dream about if they were a musician. So making money can sometimes be a problem, you know.
It doesn't quite buy happiness.
You know, quite a lot of bands, if you make a lot of money, then things can get out of control pretty quickly, you know. And the fact that we broke up with Fish when we did was because we felt like we could afford to. We felt like we were in a position where we weren't going to be poor, you know.
Yeah, also there's so much more pressure on you musically when you make money from the record companies and stuff. Because
Yeah, exactly.
it
Everybody leaves us
becomes
alone.
like, yeah, it becomes like a, oh, you've got to make more hits, do that, you know, and you might lose any kind of creative control and all the fun gets taken out of it. So, you know, there's two sides, which we discuss quite a lot.
Everybody wants to have a say or an input if they think, that they've got
There's
a
money
stake in
involved.
it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is
So I
kind
think.
of the crowdfunding thing. It's kind of good it didn't go that way because it could have easily if you turned it into a big business.
Yeah, I could see how it could become a huge distraction. And if it started to make some serious money, then we wouldn't want to give it up. And then, you could see how it would be, the music would kind of be a hobby rather than our work, Anyway.
Speaking of money, you decided to start splitting everything equally. So the publishing was still being split unequally.
Yeah, so we kind of had this. This was a hangover from the Fish days. In the very first album, we split everything equally. Then once I don't know why Fish decided, but he thought he should get more, probably because of the amount of publicity he was getting. He was the singer, he was the front man. Everybody wanted to talk to him, and they all wanted to talk about his lyrics. And so I think he kind of felt that what his contribution was more valuable than ours. That was probably his thinking. And so he wanted more, and we ended up with a compromise where instead of giving him 50% of the publishing, it was 35%, and the rest was split between us. And that system of split between lyrics and music, and also what we would do is we would try and work out who wrote what in a song, which is kind of very hard to do is when you're kind of
It's very,
writing
yeah.
together. Because somebody might come up with an idea and then somebody could change it and add to it. And, I mean, in the case of our most famous song, Kaylee, Steve Rothery came up with the guitar intro and the verse part. And the chorus was something he'd played at the end of a song called She Chameleon that I said to him, oh, we could use that as a chorus. So if I hadn't been there and said, oh, let's use that as a chorus, it probably wouldn't have even been thought of. So although I didn't write it, you can see how
Yeah, it's hard,
between
yeah.
us, we kind of, and then there's the way the songs play, the arrangement. We all contribute, So, but anyway, we ended up with this uneven split thing, which we then basically imposed it on Steve Hogarth when he joined
It's
the
weird that
band.
you did that you
It
continued
was
it
kind of
really.
just it was just the way things were done. We didn't nobody stopped to think about it. And it wasn't as crucial back then in the sense that we were earning money from record royalties, which were split equally. We were earning money from a bit of touring and a few other areas. So it wasn't like anybody wasn't earning very much. But then what happened was when we got to the mid-90s and beyond, all of our earnings kind of dried up and the publishing became a big part of what we actually earned. And then the uneven splits became really apparent, as in, certain members of the band were getting far more than others. And once we did the crowdfunding thing and all the rest of it, I remember having a conversation with Pete and Ian, because they were the ones that were at the bat, the bad end of it, in the sense that they hadn't written as much music and of course didn't write any lyrics. They were the ones that were suffering the most, really, from this uneven split. And I said, well, as I'm kind of in the middle, my share tends to be about 20% anyway. I could broker this idea to the other two that we should split everything equally because I haven't got an axe to grind in the sense I won't get more or less pretty much. I mean, it probably, it
Yeah,
was.
it would be best coming from you.
Exactly. And of course, they were like, that sounds like a good idea. And it just felt like the right time for everybody to say, okay, all for one, one for all. We're all in this together. We're all contributing. We're all working towards this, same goal. Our fortunes should rise and fall together, So, and to H's and Rother's credit, they both readily agreed, So it was a good feeling that we all, you know, it brought us to get closer together, I think. And
yeah, and you still split everything equally.
We do
to this day.
Everything, yeah. So that's a good thing. And we're not the first band to do that, by the way. Quite a few other bands, you know.
Go answer the door.
Yeah. While Tallulah answers the door, I'll talk about how other bands split things equally. Like Genesis always split everything equally. And I think Queen split everything equally, regardless of who wrote the songs. So I think it's a good recipe for a band to stay together if they all split things equally. So if you're in a band, don't forget, regardless of who writes the songs, you should all split equally. Then you'll be happy. Because money is the root of all evil, or something like that.
I can still hear you in my ears.
Can you?
Mithering on.
I was just talking about...
Queen split everything equally. Because you were making all this money from crowdfunding. Enough.
Enough, yeah. It was not like you were making piles of cash.
But 200k.
Double what we got as an advance from Castle, yeah.
You could afford to hire Dave Meegan again.
Yes.
And so let's talk a little bit about producing and recording the album.
Okay.
So this is Arachnophobia.
Anarachnophobia.
Arachnophobia is fear of spiders.
Yeah, so anorax, no phobia, as in not afraid of anorax. That was the idea.
But what's an anorak?
An anorak is like, it's kind of like a... Yeah, but somebody who's an anorak, the people don't say it anymore, but back then you called somebody an anorak, it was like being a geek or somebody who's really into their thing, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah, you were kind of embracing being uncool.
Exactly, yeah.
What was it Noel Gallagher said to you again?
No, that was years later when I was with Travis.
What did he say?
I was at some party in London and I said to him, oh, I play in a band too. And he goes, oh, who's that? I said, we're the most uncool band in the world. We're called Marillion. And he goes, yeah, you're right. Totally deadpan, you know. Yeah, you're right. And I'm like, oh, thanks. me thinking that I was being, you know, self-deprecating,
yeah.
And he just like stuck the knife in. He's a misery.
His brother's even worse.
Yeah, God. Yeah, who'd be brothers with him? No wonder he's a misery.
Anyway.
Yeah, we need to shit talk other artists a bit more, don't we?
You talk about when recording Anarachnophobia that there were issues with the mixing because everyone's arguing over who can be louder. No.
Okay, I remember what you're talking about now. So I talked about the title of If My Heart Were a Ball, It Would Roll Uphill. And I was like, why? You know, it's kind of a bit of a ridiculous title. Although Pink Floyd had a title of one of their instrumental tracks called Several Species of Small Furry Animals Huddled Together in a Cave and Grooving with a Pict. So, you know...
That's quite funny.
And so I think H was going for the world's longest title or something with If My Heart Were a Ball, It Would Roll Uphill. But apparently he said the reason why he wanted to call the song that was because in the past there'd been times where we kind of had this... I think we've grown out of it now, but back in the... I think Nick Tauber, on the first album, Script for Jester Tear, started this whole thing about if you have the vocals too loud, then the band sounds small. And it's true. If you have the vocals really loud, then the music, by definition, has to be quieter, you know. You can't have everything louder than everything else. We kind of took that on board, I suppose, because we weren't the singers. Me and Rothers, and so there was always a bit of a push to keep the vocals from getting out of control and being too loud. I have actually come round to H's point of view, don't tell him, but, you know, I think the songs generally do benefit from vocals being louder than we've traditionally had them in the early days. But at that point in our career, we hadn't really resolved that, and H was always pushing for the voice to be louder, and he was saying people couldn't hear what he was singing. And so in order to avoid anybody mishearing what he was singing, he thought he'd call the title the chorus of the song, which is, if my heart were a ball, it would roll uphill. So that was his way of saying, look, this is what I'm singing.
Well, you said on This Strange Engine, you just completely withdrew from any of the mixing because you get really angsty and worked up by it.
I used to find it so stressful because you'd get, I don't know, I suppose you get attached to how things are, you know, when you're working on them. And then when it's mixed, there's always that thing of you walk into the mix and you listen to it and you think, oh, all the stuff that I did is you can't really hear it. It's completely buried. And you know, and I'm sure it's just subjective, you know. And everybody's, feels like there's always a fight to, somebody wants this louder, somebody wants that louder, you know, somebody thinks this is too loud or whatever. And it always created a lot of stress and bad feeling. So, and what I realised, and this was a conversation I had with H when we were at a record shop signing once, you know, like 3 or 4 months after the album was finished and it was out. And we had a discussion along the lines of, God, do you remember how we kind of fought over that mix? And now I don't even remember what it was we were fighting over. And it sounds fine.
You listen in hindsight, yeah.
Exactly. So I just thought, in a year's time, I won't care. I won't ever listen to the song and think, oh, that's too loud or that's too quiet.
I get the same thing with editing stuff. I get so like worked up about little details and I'll watch it back and be like, this is actually good. But you're like, oh, crap, should have cut that or left that, you know?
Yeah. But then you never think about it again. And I just thought, okay, I'll avoid the stress. I'll avoid the arguments. I'll just not go to the mixes at all. And that's what I said to Dave. And I trusted Dave to do a good job, you know.
Do you get involved with the mixing now?
Yeah, but more out of respect for the person who's mixing it, as in I don't want him to think that I just don't give a fuck, you know?
Yeah.
I will listen. And also just to point out anything that maybe you think may be wrong with it, but not in from the point of view of, oh, this is a bit too loud or this is a bit too quiet, you know? But I think everybody's a bit more chilled about that sort of thing now.
Mm.
Let's do your birth. So, so then Tallulah came into the world. Tallulah, 12 names. Tallulah, Judy May, Eva Elsie, Jo, Philly, Maggie, Joy, Blackfoot, Moxham, Kelly.
Yeah, but I changed Joy to Jezebel.
Because Joy was your mum's business partner and they fell out in a spectacular way and we never spoke to her again. So your name had to be changed.
Yeah, and I, at age 7... loved the name Jezebel, not knowing the connotations at all. And Mum went, oh, you can change your name. And I chose Jezebel. Not knowing that what it meant. Just like
what
the
does it
name.
Mean?
You dirty Jezzy. You know,
oh, okay. Like a Jezebel is like a whore or a traitor or whatever.
it's a biblical temptress, I would be.
When you were born, it was the end of 2001, right? So... your mum was launched into her PR career business and actually started her new company. And I was spending quite a bit of time at home looking after you, which was nice. I was a bit of a stay-at-home, hands-on dad with help from Storm. Storm,
yes.
If you're listening,
shout
hi.
Out for Storm.
Yeah.
My
nanny.
Was
great.
He was hired 3 weeks before I was born or something.
5 weeks, I think it was, yeah.
Why?
No, it wasn't. It was 5 weeks after you were born.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So, but yeah, it was a nice time. And
but Mum accused you of taking over.
Well, I think I mentioned that in the book. I have this habit of if I see somebody doing something, I can sort of kind of go, I can do that. And so I kind of hover around and try and take over. Yeah, I get accused of that even now by somebody.
I do it too.
Yeah, it's kind of you kind of feel like you want to help, but you're also, but there is that thing of thinking, I can
agitation.
Do better. And, yeah, you're not doing it quite right. I can fix
Thanks
that.
Thanks for passing that down.
It's Sorry about
great
that.
Great trait.
I know, well, it didn't go down too well with your mother. Oh, well.
Is that was so? That was when you were writing Arachnophobia that I was born, or had you finished writing?
We'd finished it. It came out in 2001. We were starting to work on Marbles by then. We didn't do much touring then because nobody wanted us. We were like down to a few gigs a year. You know, it wasn't like I was away loads when you were very young, which was nice. You know, it was a good time. Okay, Tallulah. So before we go, I'm going to have a quick shout out for our new members. Thank you all very much for signing up to Patreon, which I talked about a bit earlier. And before I do the member shout out, I was just thinking I'm going to create a new chat for people to make suggestions about things that we can cover in future editions of the podcast when we get to the end of the book. We're not exactly going to be scrabbling around looking for ideas, but it'd be nice to hear what you'd want us to talk about and what you'd want us to do in the future. So a quick member shout out for everybody. Thanks so much for signing up and supporting the podcast. We have Mick Bolton, Peter Toll, Andy Wells, Colin Price. I know a Colin Price, used to work for us years ago. I wonder if it's him. If it is, hi, Colin. And if it's not, hi, Colin, anyway. Lily, we have Lily, and Jeffrey O'Donoghue, Peter Mill, Anthony Kirkham, Cindy. I know Cindy. Hi, Cindy. Saw her on the cruise. And Steve Severa, Mike Rawlins, and Scott Martin, Lee Lovelace, and Baptiste Laval. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
We'll see you next time. Thanks, Lula.
Thanks, Dad. Bye.
Chapter 18, The Mother of Invention, Crowdfunding. Welcome to Centre Parks, Port Zeeland, South Holland. Surrounded by water, with a river running through its heart, it's strangely idyllic for a holiday camp. Ducks, swans and hens amble around the chalets. Walk towards the edge of the site and you're staring out at the North Sea, a flat expanse of greys and blues as the sunshine glimmers off its surface. The ruddy gold of the sandy beach populated by Marillion fans that seem surprised by this display of beauty, as if the resort had suddenly disrobed. Take the path through the chalets that hug the cove and work inland, down towards the on-site supermarket, bars, swimming pool, and the giant white marquee Marillion have erected in the car park. The March sun is low in the sky, but the promise of summer is in the air. Almost every window and door are open. Marillion fans seated in the sunshine, cradling beers. Every doorway is filled with the sound of a different Marillion song. Each person is wearing a perfectly preserved Marillion t-shirt. Head past the Adventure Factory, which doubles as the second stage, a cavernous merchandise hall, and on Saturday host a fiendishly tough Marillion quiz. From the distance, the giant white tent, which will play home to Marillion's three shows, looks like it's fallen out of the sky and landed there. After the weekend is over and the tent has been dismantled, Marillion's crew replace the lampposts and trees they have uprooted to put it in place. Feels like a dream, doesn't it? Some mad fantasy. It was a new millennium, and the idyllic place in the sun described above was a few years off, but it hung there like some glittering prize just waiting to be unwrapped. What was it Oscar Wilde said? An idea that is not dangerous is unworthy of being called an idea at all. Anybody who has stuck with this story so far might be able to guess what's coming next, unless you picked this up thinking it was a picture book. We had a database of fans. The whole world was waking up to the potential of the internet, and the dot-com bubble that would change the world was just drifting into view. We had no record contract, and the US Tour Fund of 1997 had highlighted the fact that our fans would be willing to spend money up front when it came to the band. Saying that, it still took a few months from parting company with Castle and Sanctuary for the penny to drop. We might share the same barber, and by barber I mean that God cuts both our hair, but I was clearly no Jeff Bezos. Not that we were sitting around idly. We were beefing up our website with lyrics, news and interviews, and anything else we could think of to drive traffic there. As part of our push to become totally independent, we even decided to take on a new employee to work alongside Eric. We had no money, but one more mouth to feed wasn't going to make much difference. We had been very impressed with Lucy Jordache's work on the remastered album series, and over the years we had found out how much she cared about Marillion, even under the auspices of EMI.
We invited her to come and work for us full-time as our marketing and communications manager. Her head turned by the offer of a pay cut in the wilds of Buckinghamshire, she quickly quit London and her corner office at EMI for a porter cabin in the car park of the Racquet Club. Not just one porter cabin, we had two, affectionately referred to as kebab vans. What a perfectly tuned beast the micro-sized Marillion machine truly was. We had already started work on the next album, and we were still debating if we should sign one of the deals on offer. As Brian Wilson almost sang, God only knows we needed the money. And then, just like that, it occurred to me. We needed the money, but that was all we needed. We didn't need anything else from a record company that we couldn't do ourselves. No light bulb flash of inspiration, just a problem and a solution. Standing around in the kitchen with mugs of tea in hand, I said to the boys that we should ask the fans to buy the next album in advance through an online pre-order. The money it would bring in would fund us through the making of the album. I did a quick back of a fag packet calculation and figured that about 6,000 orders would be enough to make it work. History turns on such almost imperceptible moments, though I'm not sure they're always accompanied by a cup of Yorkshire Gold. I got a few looks that suggested I had pulled a live raccoon from a sack and deposited it on the kitchen floor, but there was general agreement among the band. Lucy and Eric were especially receptive to the idea. Understandably, all the things that might go wrong were raised. What if we didn't make enough money? Would we look bad asking for a handout? Might the fans expect some sort of control over the sort of album we were going to make? And so on. There were plenty of reasons why we shouldn't do it. But there are always plenty of reasons not to do anything. But as I argued, in the most genial way, sometimes you just have to dive off the top board and see how you land. So I pushed for everyone to at least try it. Ideas go through several stages, from impossible to dangerous to the bleeding obvious. Crowdfunding, a new word it wasn't coined until 2006, wasn't impossible since the dawn of the internet, but it wasn't as omnipresent as it is now. It still felt a bit Wild West, but I was drawn to the unknown and the untested. Much like I was drawn to speeding red sports cars and the windswept high ledges of European hotels. I like a bit of danger. How can you truly enjoy life when there isn't a small risk of death, or at least an interesting scar you can tell your grandkids about? I've always believed that taking risks is good. If it goes awry, then try something else instead. I'm either right or I may just be lucky enough to never have my belief truly tested. Our first and most pressing need as a band was to find out if the fans loved the idea as much as we did. On the 16th of June 2000, Ian's birthday, we sent out an email to 6,000 email addresses we had collected asking fans if they would be willing to support a pre-order for the next album. So that we didn't have to read all 6,000 replies, we simply asked that they send their reply to yes@marillion.com or no@marillion.com. The mailboxes are now closed in case you had something pithy in mind to send. And we could simply count the replies. Almost everyone answered the call, and there were only 200 emails in the no mailbox. Over the next few months, we fleshed out the idea of the pre-order. Sounds sexy, I'm here to assure you it's not. We needed to make the album feel like an event, so the pre-order version came with a bonus disc not available in the shops. We also offered to include the names of anybody who placed their order before the end of the year in the CD booklet. This served the dual purpose of personalising it for our backers, and it gave them a reason not to wait too long before ordering. It sounds like small beer these days, but it was pretty revolutionary at the time, as was the deluxe packaging and an array of formats. Not that I'm claiming the credit for every great idea in the campaign. These would often evolve out of the frequent chats and meetings we had. Though my enduring memory of the campaign is that Eric and I were leading the charge. Although Marillion have been credited as the inventors of online crowdfunding, and not afraid to go on stage dressed in sackcloths with eyes emblazoned on their backs either, and I sometimes get the credit as the band member who came up with the idea, it doesn't take a genius to see how it evolved from Jeff Pelletier's tour front idea. We just ran with it. Besides, crowdfunding as a concept has been around in one form or another since at least the 19th century. Remember the debentures at the Royal Albert Hall? Still, we were pioneers after a fashion. Imagine Hillary and Tenzing scaling the frozen white face of Everest, perishing wind whipping through their beards. Substitute a warehouse full of boxes of CDs and some Excel spreadsheets for one of the most dangerous peaks in the world. And that was us, pretty much. At least that's what I tell myself before I bed down each night. And almost as a happy accident, it meant that as a band we had suddenly found our way again, like stepping out of a dark forest into the light of day. Like the monomyth I referred to earlier, we had taken a journey and come back changed, but changed for the better. It was us against the world again. We were making the album we wanted to make, confident and sure of ourselves, with our fans behind us both spiritually and financially. Around this time, I brought up the subject of money and how we distributed it. For many years, we had continued to split the publishing income unequally, a hangover from the Fish years. Having not quite shed my communist tendencies, I suggested that we should revert to splitting the publishing equally again. We had been through a near-death experience and we were closer than ever. It seemed like a good time to put our money where our mouths were. Once we started talking about it, then it seemed an obvious step to split all Marillion income, whatever the source, equally, which is what we agreed to do. This was a sacrifice for H and Rothers and principally benefited Ian and Pete, but it felt good to be all equals again, all for one. As the money started coming in from the pre-orders, we also realised that we could afford to hire Dave Meegan again. Things were looking up. Dave joined us at the Racquet Club and we worked together on the arrangements and recording throughout the second half of 2000 and into early 2001. There was some discussion about what sort of album we were going to make. We felt the pressure of knowing that people were paying up front and deserved our very best, but we were brimming with confidence that we could deliver. From the uplifting opener, Between You and Me, to the roiling closer, If My Heart Were a Ball It Would Roll Uphill, we knew we had something special. I know you're scratching your head at such an obtuse song title, so I'll tell you the story behind it. It's the smallest of battles, but since the early days of the band, there had been a struggle between the music and the vocals. Which takes precedence? Who should be louder? Naturally, the singer, every singer, it comes with the territory of leading a band, wants the listener to be able to hear every word they utter. What's wrong with that? Nothing, except that if you make the vocals louder, then the instruments go down in the mix. It's simply not possible to have everything louder than everything else, as Ian Gillan famously requested during Deep Purple's performance of The Mule on their 1972 Made in Japan live album. If the vocal is too loud, then the band can sound minuscule in comparison, which might work in the pop world, but in prog rock, never. This endless war for dominance often came to a head during the mixing. It could get unpleasant when two or more members of the band had a disagreement over how a mix should sound. Not in a Gallagher Brothers I'll Break Your Guitar and Glasses way, but in a much more English way, the sort of smouldering resentment that can lead to an ulcer later in life. It's stressful and unpleasant enough that when it was time to mix This Strange Engine, I decided to give it a miss altogether. Like a spoilt child, I just refused to attend the mixes and let the rest of them and Dave slug it out. It wasn't because I didn't care. Instead, my reasoning was that no matter how upset or angst-ridden I have felt about a mix at the time, a year or two down the road when I hear the song again, I wouldn't give it a second thought. From my experience, I learned that whatever I thought about the mixes at the time would be fleeting, and I would end up listening to the songs later, like most people, and not notice that the guitar was one decibel louder than the piano, thus slightly obscuring my minor third arpeggio as we entered the chorus. Besides, I trusted Dave's mixing expertise. Got a little off track then, didn't I, embroiled as I was in the memories of the mixing wars? So why such an ungainly song title? It was H's backup plan in case the final mix meant his vocals were too quiet and that people might miss out on his carefully crafted lyrics. Calling the song If My Heart Were a Ball It Would Roll Uphill would leave no doubt as to the exact words he was singing. Thankfully, he held off including the song's entire lyric in the title, so a minor win for the rest of the musicians in the band and for the audience when he introduced the song each night. For the album, we tried to cover as many musical bases as possible, from the funk groove of Quartz to the heavy rock riff of Separated Out to the understated When I Meet God. The first song we wrote for Anarachnophobia was This Is the 21st Century. We were all very excited about how good it sounded, but not unlike many first dates, the initial spark of excitement sometimes splutters out. If Dave Meegan has a weakness as a producer, it's that he sometimes let a song outstay its welcome. Often, he can't bring himself to take a razor blade to a few unnecessary bars, which was the case with This Is the 21st Century. Lyrically, I would like to imagine H was thinking of me when he wrote the first verse. We are very different, he and I. He believes in magic, and I believe in science. It works, though. Our shared world keeps spinning. Not that I want you to think that anarachnophobia was beset by problems. It wasn't. Gripes were minor, arguments few. We got on well together, and it was a real pleasure to be working with Dave again. Even calling the album Anarachnophobia was a statement of intent we could all get behind. It was how we felt about ourselves and our fans. Prog and proud of it. Anoraks all. No more trying to be relevant or hip, whatever that was. We even had some t-shirts printed, emblazoned with the legend Marillion, uncool as fuck, which the fans loved. Us and them against the world. Which isn't to say there weren't a few teething problems. After practically pleading with the bank for a credit card machine, we had it installed in one of the kebab vans. For some reason, the bank assumed we couldn't be trusted with such a tempting piece of kit. At first, it was exciting watching the little machine process the payments and experience the money flowing into our bank account. After a while, punching in credit card numbers reminded us all of why we hadn't pursued a career in accountancy. And to think I once contemplated a bank job. It was mind-numbing stuff. Even if we did know that it was helping fill our coffers with every order, we all took it in turns to spread the tedium. Besides, Worldpay, the payment processing company, like many music critics before them, thought we were a bunch of wrong'uns. Becoming suspicious of our sudden influx of cash, they started to ask questions. They didn't like us taking payments for goods that didn't exist yet. They had a point. On the face of it, it sounded like a scam. Eventually, they agreed to release enough money to us so we could pay for the manufacture of the CDs, holding on to the rest until they'd been shipped. We now had over £200,000 in our bank account, and we hadn't signed our lives away. Having experienced the world of the indie record label of the late 1990s, we thought favourably of EMI once again. Lucy set up a meeting with her old boss, Nigel Reeve, and she, H and I, went to see him with an offer to license the new Marillion album. No advance, we simply wanted the promise of a decent marketing budget and worldwide distribution, which he accepted. Win-win, or so we thought. We learned that not having an advance to recoup meant the record company didn't have as much incentive to sell the record. Their lackluster approach to promoting the album meant that we resolved to utilise a much more hands-on approach when it came to our next record. There was also the matter of the album cover. We really liked Carl Glover's work, but felt like it was time for a new approach. We pitched the title to a few different artists. One Matt Curtis came back with the cute guy in an anorak with a coat hanger in his hand. We thought it was perfect and told him so. He then, perplexingly, proceeded to change it. We spent the next few weeks trying to get him to give us the anorak guy, who we'd christened Barry, we first saw and liked so much. It was as if he was deliberately trying to change the design we had initially approved. Eventually, after much haranguing, we got him back to where he had started and the cover was given the green light. A few months after the album was released, we found out why Mr. Curtis was so desperate to change it. Barry was a car thief. Not unlike our artist friend, ironically. In a plot twist you would scoff at if you saw it in a movie, he had stolen the image from an anti-theft poster belonging to Toyota. The coat hanger was the thief's method of gaining entry into the cars. Toyota threatened to sue for copyright infringement. EMI settled with them and went after Curtis for the money. We stayed out of it and got to keep Barry in the end. While we waited for the album to reach the shop and our subsequent European tour, Lucy booked us a short set of university shows to see if we could reach a new and younger audience. The tour lost money as the ticket price was kept deliberately low in a bid to attract the student audience. We tried to discourage our usual fans from buying up all the tickets, but it was an impossible task. They went after these new cheaper tickets the way dogs pursue squirrels in the park, but with considerably more success. One good thing to emerge from all this was that Lucy discovered she had a talent for booking tours, and what's more, she enjoyed it. She asked to be excused from her marketing and PR duties to concentrate more on the management side of things. The sky hadn't fallen in after John Arneson's departure, but there were some big holes in the day-to-day management that Lucy stepped in to fill. Things were on the up. On the 5th of December 2001, Angie gave birth to her first and my second daughter, Tallulah, Judy, May, Eva, Elsie, Joe, Philly, Maggie, Joy, Blackfoot, Moxham, Kelly. Try saying that after a few drinks. Barely able to fit it on the birth certificate, her dozen names were kind of a tribute to women and ancestors who came before her in both our families. The road to our first child took longer than we anticipated, so by the time Tallulah arrived, She was a very welcome addition to our lives, and Angie wanted her to have all the names we might have considered for any number of offspring. We had moved out of Oxford city centre earlier in the year to a bigger house surrounded by fields in the outskirts of Marcham, a pleasant village close to Abingdon. We already owned two Cavalier King Charles Spaniels, and now we had a child together too. We hired a nanny called Storm. She was a force of nature, so suitably monikered, as Angie was working long hours, and as part owner of a rapidly expanding PR company, she didn't take much downtime before returning to work. I was very much a hands-on dad, spending a lot of time with Tallulah while Angie started work early and finished late. This arrangement suited us both, as I could go to the racquet club later in the day and be home in time to take over from Storm. I was enjoying being a father the second time around, maybe even to the extent that Angie thought I was competing with her for Tallulah's attention. I have an annoying tendency to try to take over if I see somebody doing something I think I can do better, which is most things, singing and drumming aside. I may have also been subconsciously compensating for the terrible job I had made of being a father to Freya and Kai. Tallulah and I were close, developing that special bond that only fathers and daughters have. You know the one, where she wraps me round her little finger and I don't seem to notice or mind. For the first time since leaving EMI, the band didn't feel any pressure to get back in the studio and produce another album. We had a bit of time to spend at home or on other projects. I enrolled on an Open University science course. This didn't go down too well at home, but I wanted to do it for myself, if only to prove that I was capable of some academic success after my disastrous school years. I only completed the first year of the course, but I haven't given up hope that one day I may go back and get a degree.